So let me just begin by giving a little bit of an overview this evening of what we'll be doing in the coming weeks and what we'll be doing this evening. Get into that too. We can begin with the Buddha, a good place to begin. 2,500 years plus ago, the Buddha taught that our happiness and our peace, our well-being, our freedom, are not just a product of external causes and conditions of, you know, the conditions into which we're born or even the things that happen to us, but that to a very significant extent, our happiness and our well-being depends on how we meet and how we relate to our experience. You know, it's easy to think that, you know, I'd be happy if, you know, such and such a good thing happened, and if these, quote, bad things could be kept out of the way, then I'd be happy. I'd be peaceful, or I'd be kind of, I could really practice meditation. I could really be the Dalai Lama, you know, if only the conditions were right. And the Buddha's teachings really are kind of go in a different direction. He argues that happiness really depends, genuine happiness and freedom depends on how we train our minds, how we meet our experience, how we relate to the conditions that come to us both externally and internally. Essentially, he taught that our minds can be trained, and that we need to train our minds. And he provided a very extensive and a very systematic framework or practices to help train the mind. He was really a systems thinker, you know, kind of like, but it all kind of fit together, these positive qualities and these negative qualities to avoid, and they all kind of fit together in this kind of a system of training the heart and the mind to find, experience freedom from suffering. And for over 2,500 years, people have been using these practices. They've been meditating, they've been bringing mindfulness into their daily lives and have benefited from them. You know, many people over the years, over the centuries, have found, as far as we can tell, have found complete freedom from suffering through following this path of training. Others have found, perhaps, you know, much greater well-being than that they otherwise had experienced through these teachings and practices. And in recent years, particularly in the last couple of decades, scientific studies have shown that we can train our minds and we can actually change our brains. That, for one thing, our brains have the capacity to change really throughout our lives. You know, it used to be thought, probably most of us are familiar with this, it used to be thought that once you reached adulthood, got through adolescence, the challenges of adolescence, and reached adulthood, then the brain was pretty much reached a set point by then. But in recent years particularly, they've found, studies have shown, that the brain really changes throughout our lives by the activities that we engage in, that we can change our brains, and that certain practices can change our brains, can bring greater happiness and well-being. And that among those are meditation and the practice of mindfulness. And that these practices can have a profound impact both on our brains and on our lives. That what we pay attention to, what we focus on, has an impact both on our brains and on our ability to be happy, or on the other hand, be stressed out and anxious or depressed, or, you know, it depends. We actually have a choice, and how we use our mind really is a key element in this. Some of the examples of the benefits of meditation and mindfulness that we'll be talking about over these weeks, and I'll go into more depth on these studies, but just a few examples to begin with here. They found that just through a short period of training in meditation, the brain actually changes, that the density of gray matter in the brain actually increases through the practice of meditation, and areas of the brain associated with self-awareness, with compassion, with introspection, which are pretty good things, you know, actually got thicker through training in meditation, practice of meditation, for an average of 27 minutes a day. So people did an 8-week mindfulness course, mindfulness-based stress reduction course, and they averaged 27 minutes a day of meditation. And the study showed that the brain thickened in areas associated with introspection, self-awareness, compassion, and thinned in areas associated with stress and anxiety. So who knows what it might have happened if they'd have done 30 minutes a day. Just happened that 27 minutes was the average. So this is, you know, there had been studies of Tibetan monks who'd been practicing for 20, 30 years, and they found, oh, changes in the brain. And people say, yeah, well, you'd expect that, wouldn't you? If you've trained for 30 years, you've practiced meditation, you know, you've done 10,000 hours of meditation. But just in 8 weeks of about less than half an hour a day of practice, the brain changed, actually physically changed in positive areas, in areas that you could, you know, that the neuroscientists could say this is associated with more with well-being, and this is associated with more the lessening of stress and anxiety. Another interesting study that I'll be talking about in more depth in the coming weeks is one that was carried out about 5 years ago, and they found that the brain has a default network, or a default mode, should I say, where if I just invited you to sit quietly and close your eyes and not think about anything in particular, if you were just a regular person, then wherever you were from in the world, it is very, very likely that your brain would default to one of about 4 different kinds of activity, all of which are connected with mind wandering, kind of chatter, and also negative feelings. What apparently happens if just kind of the default, the kind of switch off mode, we just kind of close our eyes, we don't think of anything, is we scan our environment, we move into the future, kind of look out for what we need to worry about. We look at the past to see what we can learn from in the past in order to be able to know, you know, how we can survive and be okay in this moment. We check ourselves out in relation to other people, various ways, and I'll go into more depth on this later, but in various ways we really get into distraction, that the distraction and kind of going out from the present moment is a default mode of the brain, and it's associated with negative feelings and negative experience, you know, being in this mode. At the same time, the brain has another mode, and this is one where they're calling it an experiencing mode, where the attention is actually in present moment experience, is in our sensory experience, aware of the body, aware of breathing, aware of sound, aware of taste, touch, etc. That when we're in that mode, then we're more present, we're more joyful, it's a happier, it's a more positive way of being in the world. And they've found that that the natural mode is the default mode, but with training we can rest much more fully in this experiencing mode, and we experience less negative feelings and more positive feelings. There was a report on this study. It was called "The Wandering Mind is an Unhappy Mind." The wandering mind is an unhappy mind. And they did a very, you know, the study was of people where they checked in on them at all times, different times of the day, using, you know, iPhones and, you know, whatever, Androids, and what are you thinking about right now? And are you feeling good? And, you know, mostly people were thinking about, you know, oh, I'm worried about so-and-so, or I was thinking about the past. And that was correlated with, you know, negative feelings. But that when they were present, it was much more associated with positive feeling, with feeling okay. And the more people meditated, the more they rested in that experiencing mode rather than in the default mode. So it's another example of how the benefits of paying attention and training the mind. Just some other studies that have been done, and there's numerous of studies, but just to mention a few, studies have found that meditation may reduce the cognitive decline associated with normal aging. This wouldn't be of anything of concern to any of us here, just purely an abstract thing, but and there was a similar study was done of folks out at a 3-month retreat out in Colorado, where they tested in a similar way these telomeres, which are I have to find the details of that, but that meditation was here it says telomeres play a key role in the aging of cells, acting like a clock that limits their lifespan. Every time a cell divides, its telomeres get shorter, unless an enzyme called telomerase builds them back up again. When the telomeres get too short, a cell can no longer replicate and ultimately dies. Anyway, the study of these meditators over a 3-month retreat found that meditators had a significantly higher telomerase activity than a control group, suggesting that their telomeres were better protected, so that they were, you know, the likelihood is, and it, you know, they need to do more studies of the same kind, but that that meditation seems to protect against the ravages of aging, that the cognitive faculties are supported by the process of meditation. Some other studies of meditators experienced a 40% reduction in pain and a 57% reduction in unpleasantness of pain through the practice of meditation. Meditation reduced the brain activity in the somatosensory cortex, an area involved in creating the feeling of where and how intense a painful stimulus is. So again, I think probably we might have experienced it ourselves, that in meditation that the less we're fixated on something that's difficult or unpleasant, the more space opens up around it, and the less there is an experience, the experience of it being painful or uncomfortable or unpleasant. And that seems to be borne out by the studies too. Other studies show that meditation helps lower blood pressure, slows the progression of HIV, help reduce symptoms of chronic pain, anxiety, and depression, reduced ADHD symptoms, helped chronically depressed people. And there's a whole range of studies, and I'll give you more information on those later, but just showing that, you know, that these, that how we pay attention and the practice of kind of focusing our awareness in the present moment has very significant effects, both in the physical health, mental, emotional health. So why do we need to train our minds? You know, those are some examples of how, at least suggestive examples of how meditation can be beneficial in our lives and kind of physical and mental health. What I'll be talking about over the next couple of weeks is how our understanding of the brain has changed over, particularly over the last couple of decades, particularly in the changeable nature of the brain, the brain's neuroplasticity, but also exploring how the kind of brains that we evolved with can get us into trouble. You know, probably all of us are familiar with the kind of the understanding of the brain that developed over, our brains have developed over hundreds of millions of years, from the reptilian brain, which is kind of the original brain, and then at a later period, the mammalian brain, and then, you know, the neo-mammalian brain, the kind of the prefrontal cortex, and that we have really three brains in one, and we're, somebody I think put it, we're kind of part lizard, part squirrel, and part monkey, you know, and we got different parts kind of giving us orders at different times and helping tamp down the other one. When the lizard gets too excited, you know, the monkey says, chill out, you know, and the squirrel says, well, maybe not, you know, and you know, one of the things that's really, that I find really interesting is, and really quite helpful about the scientific studies, is that it's not as though Buddhist teachings need the imprimatur of science to say, you know, they're valid or they're, or they work or they're helpful. But what I think the studies do is I think they can help kind of normalize what is happening, what we might think is kind of abnormal or shouldn't be happening in some way. If we recognize that that when something threatening comes up, that we will respond in a kind of a reptilian way, in a fight or flight way to that, and that we, if we don't pay attention, we may create patterns that are not helpful to us, that might lead to physical ill health and illness and mental distress. For me, it's helpful to be aware that this is, these are kind of natural processes of the mind, of the for example, the response to stress or to trauma, the way the brain responds, it's just doing what it does. And what the studies are also showing is that if we bring a different kind of awareness, a present moment awareness to what's going on, then we can come back into kind of more balance, more of a sense of equilibrium in situations where otherwise we may be very much tipped into imbalance and into really distressful, fearful, painful situations. I think we're all aware that our brains, the brains we have evolved over a long period of time, and they've evolved really to help us survive. We grew up in very dangerous neighborhoods, or our ancestors did. And survival really depended on really being on the lookout for things that would threaten our well-being, threaten our survival. So the brains we developed really kind of brought into prominence, probably a better way of saying that, but we're primed to be hypervigilant, you know, for threats. Our brains develop to make negative stimulus more powerful than positive stimulus. You know, as Rick Hansen says in his book, you know, if our ancestors were out there on the plains or whatever, and something, they heard a threatening sound, better to run, even though the odds are it might not be something threatening, and run in any case, kind of, than to kind of sit around and, you know, just chill out and wait for the tiger to eat you. You know, that, so our brains develop to be, you know, to be really on the lookout, to be vigilant for threats. And as we'll be talking about, our brains have a bias towards the negative. As Rick Hansen puts it, our brains are like Velcro for the negative and Teflon for the positive. You know, there's much more of an immediacy in terms of responding to negative, to threats, to things that threaten our survival or threaten our well-being, than there is for positive things that will enhance our well-being. Because, you know, we could, you know, presumably our ancestors could have survived without the next meal, but they couldn't have survived if they didn't run away, you know, or weren't prepared to run away from what was threatening to, you know, to eat them. So the negative is really there, and we'll talk about the ways in which it's really there up front, you know, acting, we're ready to act immediately. And it's great that we can, that, you know, if we're walking on the, you know, on the sidewalk and suddenly a car kind of swerves, we're not, you know, it's great that we have a brain that doesn't say, mm-hmm. I wonder what I should do now. Maybe I'll just kind of chill out. And, you know, our ancestors wouldn't have survived if that was the approach. You know, what the brain moves into automatic reaction, you know, it's like the example of you know, walking in the woods and seeing something that looks like a snake, you know, and how even before we've done an analysis or an exploration, is it really a snake or is it something else? We've already gone into that fight or flight, ready to jump out of the way or do what we need to do. It's not like our rational brain goes, oh, maybe a snake, maybe a stick, you know. That kind of comes in later. And it's good that it does, you know. However, these survival responses play an important role when we're under threat, but it's easy to get caught up in stressful responses in situations where there isn't really a present danger. We're not really under threat in this moment. Rather, it's a fear, for example, about the future. So our bodies and minds can respond in the same way to, you know, if you're at work and you're very busy and then your boss comes along and says, I need this by tomorrow at noon, we can respond, our minds and bodies can respond in the same way as if it were a bear jumping out of the cupboard, you know, as, you know, that we go into the same kind of stress response. We go into the fight or flight mode. And the more advanced brain that we have can also work against us as well, because we can start fixating on that. Oh, my God, I'm never going to be able to do it. Oh, God, I'm going to get in trouble, you know, that this isn't going to be good for my career. I'm not going to get that promotion. Maybe I'll lose my job. And the mind, you know, we can easily, I know this is none of us here, but can easily kind of get into that proliferation. And, you know, one thing can lead to another. And again, that's, if we don't train our minds easily, we can get caught up in, you know, not just a stressful situation. Stressful situations are a natural part of life, but the optimum way of dealing with stress is something comes up, we respond to it, and then the threat has gone, or we, you know, move out of the way of it, and then we're back into equilibrium. But with our rational brains, we can take something that feels threatening, and we can stay on that elevated level of response just by going back there. By thinking, oh yeah, God, I'm never going to be able to do it. And then we stay and all of the chemicals get released and we're in that same kind of fight or flight mode as if we were escaping from the bear or the tiger. And we can get stuck in these stress responses and we suffer. And mindfulness, as we'll be discussing, is a way to break this cycle. It allows us to see that we have a choice and to not be caught up in automatic reactivity. So that's just a little bit of where we'll be going in the coming weeks. And to just summarize this piece, that there clearly appears to be a coming together of this ancient wisdom teachings of Buddhism and some other traditions as well point in the same direction with the understandings of modern science, particularly neuroscience, that we can train our minds, we can bring about changes in our brains, and in the process we can improve the quality of our lives by engaging in practices like meditation, awareness practices that allow us to shift awareness into different parts of the brain, and to cultivate, as the Buddhist teachings say, cultivate more positive states of heart and mind, and limit and not be so fixated on the negative ones. Stress and anxiety, particularly. So the results of these scientific studies are reinforcing what Buddhism has been teaching, that greater happiness and peace, less stress, less suffering, can come from how we pay attention and on how we train our minds. So in the course, we'll be exploring what the Buddha's teachings say about training the mind. We'll be talking about that mainly this evening. We'll be talking too about what the scientific studies are revealing about the changeability or plasticity of our brains. We'll be discussing how meditation appears to be quite helpful in lessening suffering and increasing well-being and peace. And we'll also be looking at specific practices that can help us to train our minds, find greater peace and well-being, and lessen stress and suffering in our lives. So what I'm going to talk about for a bit this evening is the Buddha's teachings on training the mind. Probably most of you, perhaps many of you. How many of you are familiar with the life of the Buddha, kind of the main elements of the life of the Buddha? How many are not so familiar? Let me just kind of run over the kind of the main elements of it, because the teachings are so much grounded in the Buddha's own experience, or the experience of the person who became the Buddha. The Buddha is really an honorific title, which means an awakened one, or the awakened one, somebody who has woken up to their full potential or capacity as a human being, somebody who's found complete freedom from suffering. And the person we know as the Buddha was born as Siddhartha Gautama and in the 6th century before the current era in what is today the current day Nepal. And he was born into a noble, wealthy family and lived a life of luxury and ease and comfort. And he, you know, some of the discourses, some of the talks speak about his early life. And he experienced something being missing in his life, even having all of the good things, all of the comfort. You know, there's a lot of the talks, the discourses go into, you know, how they had a palace for each season of the year, and how he had people waiting on him hand and foot, and all the food and all of the luxurious beds and all of that. And yet there was something, some sense that he had that things were, that this wasn't complete happiness, that he, you know, there was still some sense of dis-ease or unease. And the kind of the legend goes that he, that his father prevented him from seeing, you know, the kind of the darker side, the more challenging side of life. You know, the legend says that when he was born, a wise person gave a reading and a prediction that he would either become a great monarch, a great temporal ruler, or would become leave home and become a recluse, become a monk, and then become a great spiritual leader. So his father didn't want him to do the latter. He wanted him to stay within the family business, and so he kind of kept him within the confines of the kind of life of luxury. But Siddhartha went out and he saw four things that kind of woke him up to the reality of this life. He saw a sick person, an aging person, a dead person, and had the realization that even though he was young and, you know, had all of this luxury and comfort, well-being, that he would also become sick, and he, if he lived that long, would get old and ultimately die. So how could he really be happy knowing that that was his lot? And so the understanding came to him that of the importance of searching for a happiness, that a freedom that that went beyond sickness, aging, and death, that that didn't depend on conditions. And so the fourth apparition, the fourth thing he saw was a wandering mendicant, a monk who had only, you know, his robes and bowl, but also but was very serene. And Siddhartha was inspired by this to leave his life of luxury and comfort and go live the homeless life, to go out and search for the end of suffering. And for the next 6 years, he studied and practiced with teachers of his time, leading teachers of his time. He also engaged in kind of quite severe ascetic practices of not eating, you know, more than a couple of grains of rice a day, and getting really emaciated and thin, and thinking that that was the way to find freedom from suffering through mortification of the body. And a lot of people around the world still do this and think that spiritual freedom comes from, you know, from self-mortification, from these austere practices. But he came to realize that that wasn't the path to freedom from suffering. And he sat under a tree in what is today northern India, under what's called the Bodhi tree, and he determined not to get up until he'd found a way out of this this search for the end of suffering. And he sat under that under the tree, and the talk, the discourses say that he saw many, many past lives. He saw how actions led to kind of new lives, new births, how unwholesome actions kept this cycle of life going and continuing. And he saw into essentially the causes of suffering, where suffering comes from. He said suffering comes from clinging to holding on, that there's and that there's a possibility of ending suffering in our lives. If we can let go of clinging, if we can let go of holding on to anything, then there is an end to suffering, and that complete freedom is possible. And that was the realization he had under the tree there in Bodh Gaya over 2,500 years ago, which were elaborated, his understanding was elaborated in the first of his teachings, which was the teachings on the Four Noble Truths, that there is, that suffering exists, that suffering has a cause, and that cause is clinging, holding on to anything, thinking that we can, you know, that anything can be held on to, can be made permanent, is a cause of suffering. And that then that this clinging is based on not seeing things as they really are. It's based on ignorance. But once we see things clearly, then we can let go of clinging. And that letting go of clinging is the end of suffering. As the great Thai teacher of the last century says, if you let go a little, you'll find a little peace and well-being, a little freedom. If you let go a lot, you'll experience a lot of freedom, a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you'll experience complete freedom from suffering. And then he says, your struggles with the world will be at an end. And a nice kind of statement, your struggle, because we are, I think, so much struggling with the world. We're trying to control things, get the right amount of good things, and get rid of the things that cause us pain and suffering. So his so the third noble truth is that there is an end to suffering. The complete letting go leads to complete freedom from suffering. Your struggle with the world will be at an end. And the fourth noble truth is that there is a path to the end of suffering. And the path the Buddha called the Noble Eightfold Path. It's a path of training in virtue or ethics, how to live a compassionate and wise and mindful life, a training in the cultivation of wisdom, how to see things clearly as they really are, and a training of the mind, a training of the mind in meditation, in mindfulness, in concentration, and that this Eightfold Path is the path that leads to the end of suffering. It incorporates every aspect of our lives, and each element of the path supports the other elements of the path. So the essence of the Buddha's teaching is that we can train our minds, that there is an end to suffering, and there's a path of training that leads to the end of suffering. The Buddha's understanding of our minds was that our minds are like a clear and luminous. This is a quote from the Buddha, from the discourses of the Buddha, on the luminous mind. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, but it is coloured by the attachments that visit it. This, unlearned people do not really understand, and so do not cultivate the mind. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it is free of the attachments that visit it. This the noble follower of the way really understands, so for them there is cultivation of the mind. So what the Buddha is saying is our minds are luminous and clear, unclouded, but we can, this luminosity can be obscured by getting caught up, by clinging, by attaching to, like, it's almost like we can see the clear sky, but then shiny objects come into our view, you know, little baubles, and like they seem really attractive, and we get fixated on them, and it obscures our view of the clarity of the sky. In the same way, the Buddha teaches that the mind is naturally clear, but we do get attached. We do get We get caught up in wanting things. We get caught up, particularly in greed, hatred, and delusion, in clinging to things that we want, pushing away things that we don't want, and kind of disconnecting from things that feel unimportant, you know, which is really the characteristic of delusion. So whether the mind is clear whether we're caught up with attachments or not, but insofar as we're caught up in clinging, we're not really seeing things as they really are. So we need a training, a path of training, a path of practice to see through the illusions or see through the delusions, to not be caught up in the attractiveness of the shiny objects that are coming into view. That we're getting, this will make me happy. If only I had this. And when we experience that, we lose that larger, that clear vision. This is a way that a current Buddhist teacher, Mingo Rinpoche, puts it. He says, ultimately, happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of becoming aware of your mental afflictions and the discomfort of being ruled by them. So the happiness comes down to choosing between the discomfort of being aware of our mental afflictions or the discomfort of being ruled by them. In either case, there's discomfort. But in the first case, there's the discomfort that allows us to be free of the afflictions. And in the second case, if we're ruled by them, we don't find a way out of them. We just keep getting caught up in them over and over again. So better to experience, be aware of the afflictions. And then we can see what the Buddha said, we can see their impermanence, we can see their selflessness, we can see they can't be held on to even if we wanted to. But we have to bring awareness to our experience to do that, to be able to see through them. Otherwise, we'll keep you know, repeating over and over again and being caught up in the cycle of suffering. Another way it was put is by the Thai teacher Ajahn Chah, I mentioned before, who said there's two kinds of suffering. There's the suffering that leads to more suffering. You know, you can think of the suffering of addiction, where we think, oh, if only I had the thing that I want, then I'll be happy. So that we get it, and then for a moment or a little while, there may be relief or there may be comfort, but it actually only keeps us more in that cycle of suffering. You know, it strengthens that internal craving, and it's not a way out of suffering. But their second kind of suffering is the suffering, he says, that leads to the end of suffering, where we are willing to be with the affliction. We're willing to be with what's unpleasant, uncomfortable, difficult. And if we can do that, then we can find the way out of suffering. But in order to do this, we need a path of practice. We need to train our minds. The Buddha taught, if we don't train our minds, we don't see things as they really are. And then we just act out habits, patterns, and desires, clinging to what's pleasant, avoiding what's unpleasant, and we suffer. The Buddha also said that I know of no single thing, no other single thing so conducive to misery as this uncultivated, untrained mind. Nothing so conducive to misery, unhappiness, as this uncultivated, untrained mind. He said, I know of no other single thing so conducive to well-being as this cultivated and well-trained mind. So it's kind of, you know, the difference is an untrained mind, nothing can cause us more suffering than an untrained mind. You know, not even your worst enemy, he says, can cause you more suffering than your mind untrained. And if we look around us at the world and we look at history, we'll see how much suffering, how much of the war and the conflict and the violence and the greed and the aggression comes from an untrained mind. If the mind were trained, would would we, would those that are causing suffering, cause that, would they make the choices that they, that, you know, that they did? And we can look at the benefits that come from training the mind, from rather than responding to anger with anger, to actually experience how it feels to experience the hurt or the sadness or the anger, and to let that, to take that in and experience its impermanence. And the more we do this, the less need we have to just throw it back out. Because if we throw it back out, we just, we continue this cycle of, you know, of tit for tat and conflict leading to more conflict. And we see it around the world in the conflicts that have been around for so long. If we can, I mean, the Buddha said we can end the suffering, but it has to end with us. It has to end now. It has to end by being willing to be with our experience as it is. And this is the training that the Buddha teaches and the Buddha speaks about. Without this training, we don't really have much choice. We don't have much sense that there is an alternative, that if somebody does something to us, you know, we get, our buttons are pushed, then what else can I do but scream at them or give them a finger or whatever it might be, you know. But if there's a training of the mind and the heart, we can see, yes, that's one option, but there's an alternative, and that is to just stay with the experience. Allow it, you know, see its impermanence. See that it's not me. It's not personal, unless I make it personal. And then if I'm able to do that, then there's the possibility of, you know, it doesn't mean we don't say anything or don't do anything, but what we say and do then comes from a different kind of place, and it's not a place of reactivity, you know, and a kind of automatic response, but it can come from a place of deeper compassion and wisdom and awareness. So at the core of this training of the mind is the practice of paying attention to how things are without judgment. You know, the practice of mindfulness. Mindfulness allows us to see how clinging leads to suffering, and that freedom comes from letting go of suffering. Mindfulness really is the path to seeing clearly, to clear seeing. And the practice of insight meditation or vipassana meditation is a practice of clear seeing. Vipassana means seeing clearly. Mindfulness leads to insight, leads to seeing things as they really are rather than as our everyday mind might think they are. You imagine the difference, or maybe you know the difference, probably we do, between experiencing anger and being really caught up in it, being swept away by it, and experiencing that same energy but bringing awareness to it. You know, I think of it as like, you know, one is like being carried away by a wild horse. It's almost like we don't have any control over it because the energy is kind of pulling us along. But with awareness, the space can open up, that we can see, oh, okay, yeah, this is unpleasant, this is hot, this is tight, this is tense, whatever it is, and to be with it. Then we begin the practice of training the mind. So that wild horse, you know, with training, can become a trained horse, a tamed horse. And that's really what we're doing with these minds. And the practice of mindfulness, and the other practices we'll be talking about, is a key doorway or pathway to finding freedom from suffering. I mentioned that mindfulness, the Eightfold Path, which mindfulness is one of the elements of the path. And at the core of the Buddha's teachings on training the mind are two essential practices. The first is to, as he said, abandon what is unskillful. The first is to abandon what is unskillful, and the second is to cultivate the good. So these two parts, really, to this practice. One, to let go of states of heart and mind that lead to suffering, and second, to cultivate states that lead to happiness and well-being. So obviously we want to limit and lessen the afflictive states of mind, and we want to enhance and encourage and develop the positive states of heart and mind. So abandon what is unskillful. The Buddha said, abandon what is unskillful. You can do this. If I didn't think you could do this, I wouldn't ask you to do it. If I thought that by abandoning what is unskillful, that this would lead to harm and suffering, I wouldn't ask you to abandon what is unskillful. But since it leads to happiness and well-being, I ask you to, or invite you to, encourage you to, abandon what is unskillful. So abandoning greed and hatred and cruelty and other unwholesome states of heart and mind. And he said, cultivate the good, develop and maintain wholesome, beneficial states such like compassion, generosity, gratitude, loving kindness, joy, many, many positive, wholesome states of heart and mind that enhance well-being, that allow us to feel happy, joyful, peaceful, calm, at ease. And these states of heart and mind are conducive to inner peace and to freedom. So the Buddha said, cultivate the good. You can cultivate the good. If I didn't think you could cultivate the good, I wouldn't ask you to do it. If I thought that cultivating these states would lead to harm and to suffering, I wouldn't ask you to cultivate the good. But because they lead to happiness and to peace, I invite you to cultivate these qualities, these states of heart and mind, cultivate the good. So for over 25 centuries now, the Buddhist teachings have been saying that our minds are not fixed, that we're not purely a product of our conditioning or our circumstances. That clearly causes and conditions have led to who we are and where we are right now. You know, things that we've done in the past have contributed to what is present in this moment. You know, that we are the product of the, you know, things that are outside of our control, but also of the choices that we've made ourselves. You know, if over our lives we've cultivated anger, that we've kind of had this belief that, you know, I have a right to be angry and people never do, you know, never behave as they should be behaving. And we reinforce these thought patterns and that we act them out when somebody does something to us, we get angry with them. Then what we're doing is we're really cultivating anger. And so the more we cultivate anger, the more in any given moment, the more that's likely to come up for us as a response to some kind of stimulus, you know, that feels aggravating or feels uncomfortable or feels, you know, distressing. We're likely to, you know, we've sown those seeds, and that's what we're reaping in the present moment. We're reaping what we've sown in the past, and also some things that are, you know, come from our culture and our conditioning and all of that. But many of them come from what we've sown ourselves. Sometimes we've responded to things, it's been the best we could do under the circumstances at that time, but maybe isn't the best thing for us, you know, 20, 30, 40 years later, but we still may be acting out those responses from before. But where our freedom lies, the Buddha teaches, is in how we respond in this moment. We can't do anything about the past. You know, all of that, you know, that's all gone by. Help to create the moment we're in right now. But we do have, our freedom lies in how we meet this moment. And that's where this training of the mind comes in. That if we can meet this moment with awareness, with kindness, with, you know, the practice of just welcoming this moment as it is, then we can see into the emptiness, really, of all phenomena, that everything comes and goes, that nothing can be clung to as I or mine. And we can, in seeing things clear as they really are, seeing things clearly, we can find a way out of suffering. So in this moment, how we meet this moment really is the gateway to freedom from suffering. It also creates our future moments. You know, the more present I am or you are in this moment, the more we're creating our future moments of being present. The more distracted we are in this moment, the more we're sowing seeds of you know, greed or anger or distraction, the more those qualities are likely to arise in the future. So essentially we have a choice about how we meet this moment, how we meet any moment. But it calls on us to pay attention here and now. And that's really the path of training that the Buddha laid out and the Buddhist teachings provide for us.